The Israel Report for the latest news and insights with Anthony Reich.
Anthony Reich, a very good morning. How are you?
Boker Tov. Yes, vicious rumors swirling around the place about the well-being of a Hezbollah leader, Hassan Nasrallah. Unofficial reports suggesting he might even have passed away. I'm not sure about that at
all. Look, he didn't look very well, Anthony. In that last video of his, he looked like he needed a vitamin B shot and a call from a friend. You know, he really wasn't looking good.
He was not looking good at all, and I think that that may well have given people the opportunity to put out some unsubstantiated rumors about his well-being. Nothing official that I've seen to even suggest that he is not in a good way. But certainly lots and lots of reports and rumors on the unofficial market. So we'll have to just see. But certainly nothing formal at the moment that we can point to would suggest that any of that is true. I did also want to come to Michael's question from yesterday about how many civilians Hamas actually killed themselves, how many Hamas terrorists were killed in the recent Operation Guardian of the Walls. Thank you for the question, Michael, because it is relevant. And unfortunately, I'm not going to be able to give a very scientific answer because the information that's available is really unreliable. But what I've managed to get hold of is that the UN and Gaza Health Ministry sources stated that 256 Palestinians had been killed, people in Gaza. They claim that out of those 256, 66 were children and 40 were women, which means 106 women and children, leaving 150 others. And then they went on to say that out of those others, 80 were Palestinian fighters. Now, Israel has an entirely different claim. Israel claims that 225 of the people killed were actually militants. Again, these are numbers which can't really be independently substantiated because they just contradict each other. And also in terms of the number that were killed by Hamas rockets by themselves, we don't really know. But we do know that 640 Hamas rockets actually landed in the Gaza Strip out of the 4,500 or so rockets that were fired. I can't remember the exact number, but it was certainly more than 4,000 rockets that were fired towards Israel. More than 600 of them actually landed within the Gaza Strip. We do know that they did cause, that there were casualties amongst, as a result of those rockets landing short. But again, numbers are very, very difficult to come by. And so we can't really substantiate them. So that's unfortunately the best that I can do to answer that particular question. And one of the other things that we're going to talk about, I guess, as the time gets nearer, is Shemitah year, which is up and coming, very relevant to Israel. Lots and lots of interesting things happening ahead of Shemitah. So we're just planting that little seed of idea at the moment. Apparently cameras and drones are going to be used in order to police Shemitah to make sure that things are being done according to the rules of the various far-flung crops sites, agricultural sites in Israel, to ensure that the rules of Shemitah are adequately adhered to. And of course, lots of work going on at the moment to secure alternative sources of fruits and vegetables that will be needed in Israel during Shemitah year, which begins on Rosh Hashanah in September this year.
Indeed. Of course, going back to rumors, what is going on with the Israeli government? We thought by Sunday night, Monday, now we're Tuesday. Is this happening or is this not happening?
I think it is happening. I think there's lots and lots of politics being played in the process. Apparently yesterday there were some slight hiccups along the way as Yair Lapid tries to put the government together. Apparently there was a little battle over some of the minor, more junior positions when the government's deputy ministers and ministries of slightly smaller departments within the government. The Kahol Lavan faction were apparently fighting with the Yesh Atid faction, with the Tikva Chadasha faction. Everybody was having a little battle about how many ministries they ought to be entitled to as a result of the number of seats that, they represent in, the Knesset. There was also some sort of discussion about who or who should not be a member of Israel's Security Cabinet going forward. So those were the little discussions, little battles that were going on yesterday. I think Yair Lapid has really tried to do whatever he can to keep all of that out of the press. It is inevitable that those battles will take place. Apparently, even Mansour Abbas has tried to demand a deputy ministry for his Ra'am party, even though they won't even be part, officially part of the ruling coalition. But as we all understand, even if you're supporting the government from the outside, from outside of the coalition, that action doesn't come for free either. So as things stand at the moment, we know that Yair Lapid has until tomorrow midnight to present his government to outgoing President Ruvi Rivlin. There are rumors, very strong rumors, that in fact they will manage, they being Yair Lapid and of course Naftali Bennett, who will very likely accompany him. They are likely to present the government to President Rivlin already today. That then gives Knesset Speaker Yariv Levine a week to hold a vote of confidence in the government in order to constitute that government. If we understand the rumors that are coming out of the Likud press mill, Yariv Levine is intending to use the whole week until he actually brings that vote of confidence, whereas Yair Lapid and Naftali Bennett would like their vote of confidence to take place right away, within 24 hours probably of the presentation of the government to the president. The Likud will probably use a tactic to delay the vote in order to somehow sow some seeds of doubt within those people who have today or yesterday agreed to vote in favor of the government, and give a little bit of time where they might choose to change their mind and not support that government when the vote of confidence finally is brought a week later. So the way that things are looking at the moment is that the government will be presented to President Rivlin today. The vote of confidence will likely only take place next week because the Likud will purposefully delay the vote in order to try somehow to torpedo the constitution of the government. The likely event is that the government will finally be voted in next week, and we will see Naftali Bennett take over as prime minister, and the Netanyahu family be moved out of the presidential, of the prime ministerial residence in Balfour Street in Jerusalem, which is something that a lot of people have been waiting for. There are social media adverts going out asking for people to volunteer to come and help them move out of the prime minister's residence. A lot of people are very, very happy to do
volunteer.
This has become a thing. The prime minister in Balfour Street. Ironically, some of the potential solutions that the prime minister had presented about rotation of prime ministers with a Likud-led government had involved, for example, Gideon Saar being prime minister first, and then Netanyahu second, and potentially Naftali Bennett third, for those who believe that those rotations would have taken place. But the irony was that the Netanyahu family was always going to be resident in Balfour Street, no matter who was going to be the prime minister under all of those scenarios.
Which
so
tells
this
you
whole
everything.
Issue about, the link, the whole hold on the prime minister's home in Balfour Street has become something of a symbol of the Netanyahu prime ministerial role and period. But that's what things are looking like at the moment. And of course, that will be one of the last actions that President Ruvi Rivlin is likely to take, undertake as president of Israel, because tomorrow we have the vote as to who will be the new president. And so we will discuss that tomorrow. That's going to be an interesting event indeed as well.
Just absolutely incredible. What happens during this to the religious, the ultra-Orthodox parties? Because they're not included in this coalition, right?
They are not included in this coalition, so they effectively will go into opposition.
And this is the first time in a very long time that they wouldn't have had a seat in at the table.
That is correct. I mean, for some people, they say having the ultra-Orthodox parties in the coalition is a very simple thing, because you always know where they're going to, where their allegiance is going to fall. And that means that their allegiance, they are very, very parochial in the way that they view life. They don't necessarily have a political view or broader political view about operations, about security, about Israeli economic issues. Their interests are very, very strictly linked to their own community. And as long as they're able to influence the things that their community is seeking, which is largely budget funding for the yeshivot and for the kollels and for other activities that the religious community partake in, as long as they get that and as long as they have influence over land issues and, you know, building construction rules and, of course, religious affairs to the extent which Shabbat may be transgressed or may not be transgressed according to what's happening. Those are the things that they're interested in. And so they're considered to be relatively easy to influence to support other government initiatives as long as they get those things that they want. But on this, and of course, financially, it costs the country a great deal because they get, you know, some people would consider to be a disproportionate share of the budget per capita. As opposed to other Israelis. And of course, there is this little sensitivity that they don't serve in the army, that they're not obliged to serve in the army. They have some sort of an exemption from serving in the army. So there is a great deal of controversy around the role of the ultra-Orthodox parties in the government. And I think that there'll be one or two people around Israel who'd be quite happy to see them outside the government, at least for now.
I do want to talk about Iran, but just before I do, did Naftali Bennett try with the religious parties, or did he not include them on an issue of principle?
I don't think he really had made any big effort to include the ultra-Orthodox parties within the change coalition. And the reason for that is that he understood from the outset that the main protagonists within the change coalition, particularly Avigdor Lieberman, but also to some extent Yair Lapid, would not contemplate the possibility of sitting in a coalition, including ultra-Orthodox parties. That is just against everything that they would be willing to do right now. And so the idea of trying to include some of those in the change coalition would have potentially broken it apart at the seams and it caused others to leave rather than to wish to remain. So I don't believe that he made any significant effort to bring the ultra-Orthodox parties in with him.
All right, let's quickly talk about Iran, because I think this is an important development. Iran has failed to explain traces of uranium at a number of different locations. Who's demanding to know this? What's the status of
it? Well, this is really the UN nuclear watchdog, the International Atomic Energy Agency, and in the form of its Director General, Rafael Grossi, who have been to Iran. They have undertaken some of the checks, some of the inspections that they're obliged to undertake, not only under the agreement that was signed with the P5+1 nations back in 2015, but indeed what the International Atomic Energy Agency is entitled to undertake, knowing now that Iran has this nuclear facility, the International Atomic Energy Agency has certain rights and obligations to undertake checks and inspections to see what is happening there. And Rafael Grossi is saying that he is very concerned that the technical discussions between his agents in Iran have not yielded what he calls the expected results. And then he goes on to say that after many months, Iran has not provided the necessary explanation for the presence of nuclear material particles at any of the three locations where the agency has conducted complementary accesses and inspections. So he is saying quite clearly that there are questions to be answered, that Iran is not answering the questions, and that he is extremely concerned about what's happening. And then an official statement that was made by the International Atomic Energy Agency has said that Iran's enriched uranium stockpile is currently 16 times greater than the limit that was laid down in the 2015 deal. Now, the point is that we know that Iran has been transgressing the agreement. At the moment, they would turn around and say, well, we're not really trying to adhere to the agreement because guess what? The United States withdrew anyway. And so as far as we're concerned, all bets were off the table. The truth of the matter is that, ironically, the European powers have continued to adhere to the terms of the agreement, even though the U.S. withdrew and even though Iran has clearly been transgressing the terms, not only the European powers, but indeed Russia and other powers that are involved. So this is a really confusing situation, and once again, just evidence that Iran is intent upon transgressing those rules no matter what is signed up. And I just wonder what that means in terms of the Joe Biden administration's attempts to re-enter and to re-engage on this issue.
Yeah, it is going to be interesting to follow that story. Anthony Reich, thank you as always. It is 8 o'clock. We'll catch you tomorrow morning at 7:45 to get the latest news from Israel.